And then our next speaker now will be Robert Mullen from the Potash Corpus Saskatchewan to talk about potash.
Thank you, Kyle. Good afternoon. I see a lot of familiar faces out in the audience. It's always nice. As you attend these meetings, as you start to get a little bit older, and I realize I don't think I'm that old. As I walk around, I notice that the age of the attendees is getting lower. I don't know if that's because I'm getting older, or maybe we're doing a better job of infusing some youth into the societies themselves. It's a pleasure to stand up here this afternoon. I'm obviously going to be talking about potassium. As Kyle mentioned, I find it interesting, specifically on the phosphates. I just a couple of comments. If you look at the way it's done in Florida, it's an acre per acre. For every acre that they mine, they actually have to reclaim an acre associated with the acre that they're mining. The nature of the agreements that we have in North Carolina, we actually have to reclaim 2 acres for every 1 acre that we mine. The biggest cost associated with the production of phosphate, specifically domestically, is probably the environmental issues that we have to deal with as an industry. And that makes it very difficult when you compare that to how a lot of phosphate is produced internationally at the global scale. Some of these operations are in countries that don't necessarily have the most stringent of environmental policies. And that makes it very difficult for a domestic producer to remain competitive. And we could have a long, lengthy, and maybe we'll save that for the actual panel discussion. So switching gears, talking about potassium, as a graduate student, I did have an interest in history, and I had the pleasure of serving under Dr. Gordon Johnson and Dr. Bill Ron at Oklahoma State University, and Gordon Johnson was a huge fan of history. He drug us as graduate students back to the mid-1800s, and we talked about individuals like von Liebig, and we talked about Jethro Tull, and for those of us who are a little bit older, I'm not talking about the rock band. And as I've transitioned from academia into the industry side of this and start learning a little bit more about the potassium side, it's really interesting the history of the way we came, in some regards, stumbled upon some of these sources of fertilizer that we're utilizing very extensively today. So as a big part of my presentation this morning, this afternoon, I apologize. I have to read this before I get started. I won't. I do have a couple of forward-looking comments in here. I do talk a little bit about the markets because it tells us a little bit about how the products that we produce are being consumed, and it also tells you about the geographic distribution about where these products are actually located. So if you take my advice and make an investment, that's a really bad idea is basically what this says. Don't do that. I want to talk first off about the potassium deposits. I apologize to any of the other companies that are represented here. The potash industry, it's not quite as diversified as the phosphate industry, and it has everything to do with the nature of the supply. I see Compass Minerals represented over here. I'm very mindful of everybody that's in the room. There's not as many potassium players domestically as you see with phosphate. And a lot of that has to do with the geographic distribution of the materials that we're actually mining. So, Kyle, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's I can't remember the number. There's several, at least approaching 50 different known deposits of phosphate, and it's probably higher than that, around the globe. And we're always finding new deposits of phosphate. Potassium is a slightly different animal. Potassium is, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but potassium is primarily the result of trapping of inland seas. And as they're trapped, they evaporate, and then we get glaciation, we get deposits of clay, and that's going to occur over several million years, and we get deeper deposits of these materials. And the extent of potassium reserves is much, much smaller than what it is for phosphate. So I do want to spend some time talking about the nature of those deposits. And again, I'm not going to be able to touch everybody because the nature of the deposit is going to be very specific to the geology and the geography of where those deposits actually occur. So you're primarily going to be getting a little bit of a Saskatchewan-centric perspective. But I do want to talk a little bit about the history of how a lot of these reserves were discovered, specifically the initial ones in Germany and then the primary mines that Mosaic, Agrium, and PCS operate on in Saskatchewan. A little bit about how they got there. As Kyle said, I'm an agronomist by training. I'm much more comfortable talking about LSDs and statistical significance than I am talking about engineering. this is the hardest presentation we have to do, because this actually requires me to study a little bit more. And then I do want to talk about the global balance, because when you think about potassium, and again, it has everything to do with the geographic dispersion of these deposits, it's a globally traded commodity. That's essentially what we're dealing with. And then I want to transition into the production side. Kyle did a tremendous job. I was hoping he would do that, so I wouldn't spend as much time on the technical aspects. I will get into them a little bit, specifically talking about the dry mining operations. And again, I'm not going to touch on some of the companies like Compass Minerals, some of the other ones that actually are not necessarily involved in dry mining. They're actually mining salt brines, and it's a completely different process. And I'm not going to have the time or the capacity to speak to that this afternoon. We at PCS will occasionally invite academics to attend a mine tour with us, and it's, don't everybody start clamoring for a position. It's fairly selective. It's not that selective. But one thing that often is mentioned, and this will be more apparent as I get into the presentation, you're traveling down several hundred feet. It's multiply that by 10, and you think that that's probably going to be the most impactful thing about what you're going to notice about the actual mining of this ore, is getting below ground and seeing how this operation takes place and the nature of the ore body that you're actually mining. It's really, really cool. And I'm sure that the other presenters in this particular session would agree. We have the opportunity to work with some of the most talented geologists and chemists within our respective companies that do a tremendous job at telling those mine engineers where they need to be positioning those miners to be as efficient as extracting potassium out of that ore body as they possibly can. But what's really interesting is once you leave the below ground, and believe me, it's very impressive, what's even more impressive is the way we process this material above ground. So I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about the above ground processing. Some individuals think, and I hear this a lot, and I'm sure Kyle and probably even Greg or even Alan, you just grind rocks up from the deeper into the soil, into the earth's crust, and you grind that up and then you sell it as fertilizer. Well, it's a little bit more involved in that. You got a hint of that from Kyle's presentation, more than a hint of that from Kyle's presentation. So a little bit about history. I really should have done these animated, but that's okay. Did anybody read that slide? Did you read the first bullet point? Dang it. I'm really bad about that. I was terrible about this when I was teaching graduate students. Do you realize that the first patent ever issued in the United States of America was for processing potash? How many knew that before reading the slide? Okay. I had to add that little caveat because you didn't get a chance to read that. That was actually back in 1790. That I actually have a copy, not the original copy of the document. Obviously, it's a digitized form. But it's actually signed by George Washington. So the nature of, or the history of potash, specifically with the United States, is a long storied history. And now, the process that he was submitting the patent application for is slightly different than what we do today. So the potash industry has been around for a good long while. I think there's evidence of it going all the way back to the Middle Ages. But primarily potash, and hence the term that we have derived potash, was from the burning of wood, the generation of the ash, and then we actually will leach that ash, and then we'll put it into, a person will put it into a large iron pot, and then they would evaporate, and they would get this white material, and hence the term pot ash. And that was the original source of potassium chloride. Actually, it was potassium carbonate that was used for the generation of potassium for a lot of different uses, primarily in soaps, glass manufacturing, and even saltpeter. Does saltpeter play any historical importance in this whole conversation? For those of you who know what saltpeter is, and it's going to play a little bit here in another moment. The ability to generate saltpeter was kind of important back in the day when we were trying to figure out how to manufacture gunpowder and make things that are spherical, travel at high velocity, and make impact with animals of some extent, whether that's other creatures that we're trying to consume or people we're trying to wipe out. So that was a big part of the potassium story. And again, it's a really interesting portion that I'm not going to have any more time to dedicate to it. Now, again, think back to your knowledge of the history of soil fertility, and I go back to von Liebig. And when did we first discover that this potash material that was being generated by the burning of these wood products and producing this ash, we leach the ash, we get this white product, we really didn't know that was a good fertilizer source until those German chemists really started being a little more inventive and recognizing, hey, you know what, these crops need more than just water to complete their life cycles. And no surprise that in the 1850s, when they first discovered it was a good use, it wasn't actually used as a fertilizer in the U.S. until 1873. In 1851, the Germans were doing I can't remember what the nature of the deposit they were actually looking for, but they discovered mineral potash by accident. And that's where, interestingly enough, a lot of the mining engineering associated with dry mining of potash actually has been exported from Germany into, I'm going to call it the New World, but that's kind of an older term. Now, what's really interesting, again, the historical perspective on this. So, does anybody remember what happened in 1914? And I realize the probability that anybody in this room was actually around for any of these events to transpire is pretty limited. How many have read a historical document? You know what happened in 1914. What happened in 1914? Oh, don't go to nitrogen. That's going to be Greg's talk. But that also has ties to World War I, which is what I'm ultimately trying to get to. So in 1914, so prior to the start of World War I, the only ratable source of potassium that was being used globally was coming out of Germany. And, you know, Germany kind of gets a bad rap for World War II, but they were also not necessarily our allies in World War I. In fact, they were the opposite of an ally. So when those trade routes were starting to be disrupted, the U.S. government initiated an act, we need to go find our own domestic reserves of potassium. And that actually led to the discovery of the first potassium reserve in North America, that being the Carlsbad operation down in New Mexico. It was actually discovered, looking at some historical documents, I've read it's as early as 1915 is when it was discovered, but I've heard it as late as 1926. I'm not going to quibble about that 11-year span, but it really didn't bear any usable potassium until 1931, is when we actually first started producing our own domestic source of potash. It wasn't until 1942, so 1942, another important year in the history of the world, the beginning of World War II, and if you go back and look at, you know, when you think about, as bad as wars are, they do a really good job of focusing the mind. And in the 1940s, again, because of the disruption of trade routes where oil was being moved around and how these various sides of this particular disagreement were positioning themselves, we need to make sure we have a ready supply of energy. In North America, we started looking within Saskatchewan for deposits of oil. And again, that shouldn't be any surprise because there are some pretty sizable deposits of oil in that particular geography. But during that search, they actually discovered the first domestic, or not the domestic, but a larger source of potash that we had access to. What's really interesting is that it was first discovered in 1942, but the initial deposit was discovered sort of on the southeastern side of the deposit. That's not going to make a whole lot of sense right now, but when you see the slide that displays the actual nature of the ore and how it's deposited in Saskatchewan, that first discovery in the southeastern side of that particular deposit was way too deep to actually be mined effectively, cost effectively. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we start talking about the actual mine engineering associated with the production of potash, at least in Saskatchewan. It wasn't until 1946, so they discovered it in 1942, but it wasn't until 1946 that they actually discovered a deposit that was closer to the Earth's surface that actually made sense economically to actually mine. And the depth of that particular deposit's about 3,500 feet below the surface of the earth. So if you happen to visit one of the potash mines in Saskatchewan, you're going down at least 3,000 feet to where the actual mine operation is occurring. Now, there are some mines that are deeper than others, but that's basically going to be the minimum depth that you're going to have to travel to find those deposits. What's really interesting and what has made this such a tremendous find as it relates to potassium production, it's not just the quality of the ore, because it is one of the highest quality ores that we've found globally, but it's also the thickness of the deposit. So the particular deposit, now, in this particular slide, I say it's 3.3 meters, but there are areas where it's as deep as 7 meters. That's a nice, rich, thick seam that's capable of being mined. Now, the first mine shaft was not actually sunk until the 1950s. And what's really, really interesting about the potash industry, and Kyle, again, and Alan, you guys can correct me if I'm a little bit off on this. I think the last greenfield expansion, and that's a term we use in the industry, greenfield means the sinking of a new shaft. Now, there's actually a couple of new greenfield mines being developed right now, but the last greenfield mine that's currently in operation, I think, was back in the 70s. I want to say 74, and I don't know if that's exactly correct. So we're operating within an industry where the players that are involved, these mines have been in operation for a good long while, and we're just now starting to see reinvestment back into the production side to generate new greenfield operations, to bring more ore to the surface to generate fertilizer. And since I don't have this in here, I will go ahead and speak to this. One of the challenges associated with expanding these deeper mine operations is the capital expenditure required to develop that new greenfield mine. And Greg will probably speak to this here in a moment, but ammonia production facilities, $1.5 to $2 billion investment, and you can get an ammonia facility up and running. And in probably less than 3 years, somewhere along that time scale. And again, Greg can correct all the mistakes I make when he stands up and speaks. Potassium, we're talking somewhere in the magnitude of $7 to $8 billion capital expenditure. And that cost is not going down, as you could probably imagine. And it's going to take somewhere in the magnitude of 5 to 7 years before you ever bring a ton to the surface to sell. So that's a fairly sizable inhibitor to breaking into that production industry. And I've already shared this, but I'll go through this. I'm glad Kyle went first, actually. I was going to make the argument that the potash should have went first, since we're talking about we're going from really, really deep to the surface, and then you're going to go to the atmosphere. But Alan's going to screw that up when he starts talking about micronutrients. so that argument fails. Most of the potassium deposits that we are actually mining globally are well below the surface layers. We're not talking about strip mining for potassium. All of these are going to be deeper wells or deeper mining operations. Now, just to give you an example, we operate the bulk of the potassium mining in Canada is occurring in Saskatchewan. We're the only company that operates a separate mine on the east coast at New Brunswick. So the depth of the mines that are operating in Saskatchewan are somewhere around 1,000 meters. Our particular mine in New Brunswick is only to a depth of 400 to 700 meters, depending upon the nature of the deposit where the mining is actually occurring. So again, you start to see, and again, I can't speak to any of the deposits that are in Western Russia or in Eastern Europe, where there's also a considerable amount of mining that's going on. And like I mentioned in the introduction, there is some potassium generation or mining. Maybe mining isn't the right term. That is occurring with the salt brines. That's going to occur in the Dead Sea area. A particular company, ICL, Israeli Chemical, and then the Great Salt Lake with some of the companies like Compass Minerals. And again, forgive me, I'm not a geologist, so I'm going to muddle through this as best I can. Now, when you think about where Saskatchewan is geographically, we all recognize that just to its west, you've got this rather small mountain range that separates the central prairie areas from the coast. And as a result of tectonic shift, not just necessarily west of Saskatchewan, but also on the north edge, we got the isolation of an ancient sea. And again, estimates are somewhere 326 million years ago, I think, is the number that's out there. So that is actually what caused this evaporite deposit to actually form there in central and southern Saskatchewan. Now, and again, I'm not a mineralogist, but the minerals that dominate this particular deposit are sylvite, and my suspicion is we're all familiar with that particular mineral, halite, which polyhalite actually had its own session here this year, carnallite, and sylvanite. And sylvanite is basically a mixture of halite and sylvite. That is the actual ore seam that we are mining, is a combination of those four primary minerals. Now, this is a really interesting. So this is the expanse. Let me see if I can get my cursor to... Kyle got it to work. And anything Kyle can do. This is the actual expanse of that deposit that we're mining in Saskatchewan. So this goes... The scale may be a little misleading because most people don't realize just how far latitudinally Saskatchewan goes. So Saskatoon would not be what you would consider the southern edge of Saskatchewan. It would definitely be more central. So that deposit covers and blankets most of the east central or west central portion of Saskatchewan and goes all the way down into the Regina, all the way over into Manitoba, and even just down into North Dakota. Now, as I had mentioned, sort of in passing, the southern extent of this particular deposit is at a much deeper level than it is further north. And you also see a little bit deeper deposit as you move from west to east. But this is the extent of this particular deposit, and we have the three companies that are mining in that geographic area represented, with the red being the Potash Corp, the blue being the Mosaic, and the yellow being the Agrium facility. Now, what's, again, thinking about the depth that these mining operations are actually occurring, and again, this is, I had a previous slide, but the resolution was terrible, so I ended up working with this one. This is actually going from west to east. There's actually three different deposits within this main deposit of these minerals that are potassium containing that we're actually mining. Now, what's really interesting is as you get to these deeper depths, you can't necessarily rely upon dry mining operations. And this probably makes some logical sense when you consider the amount of pressure exerted based upon the size of the overburden that we're actually mining under. So the deeper the depth, the larger the extent of the overburden, the more pressure exerted. We could actually mine at these deeper depths, but we wouldn't be extracting much in the way of ore. Oh, good grief. I didn't think I had enough slides. Global potash deposits, just to give you an idea, 46% of the known deposits. Now, again, we will occasionally find a new potash deposit, but it's certainly not like the phosphate industry where it seems like we're pretty regularly discovering a new phosphate ore body that we can actually mine. Potassium is a lot more limited. About 46% of the known reserves are contained within Saskatchewan and Canada. That's going to include the East Coast as well. 35% is in Russia and about 8% in Belarus. There's some smaller deposits that are being mined. There's actually some greater potential here in Brazil. There's some cost issues associated with some of that operation. Chile, the United States, obviously, Jordan and Israel, Germany, and then China also has a mining operation. Just to give you an idea of the distribution and where these products are actually used. So as you can probably imagine, Canada produces about 17 million tons of this product annually. Not a big consumer. And if you know anything about prairie soils, that's not a dramatic surprise. The U.S. is a very small producer, but based upon the nature of our Midwestern soils and the Eastern U.S., a fairly large consumer of potash. Latin America, again, a very large consumer, very small production. The former Soviet states, that's going to primarily be Russia and Belarus, large producers, very small consumers. What's really interesting is that about 77% of the potash is actually traded globally. Only 23% of it is actually domestic sales. So again, it's a very globally oriented fertilizer material. All I really want to say about this is that the consumption of the products that we produce, specifically on the potassium side, are increasing. 2014 was a record year for the potash industry. We actually eclipsed 60 million metric tons of potash shipped globally. We're going to be a little bit below that this coming year. That's my one forecast, hence the boilerplate statement at the beginning. Really quickly, ramping into production. It's obviously dramatically different. We're talking about tighter spaces associated with potassium mining, although you would be amazed if you get the opportunity to go into a potash mine. Some of the chambers that we actually operate in are as tall as the ceiling. And it's not quite as claustrophobic as most people envision when they actually visit a potash mine. This is one of the boring operators that we actually maintain at several of our locations. Kyle mentioned the size and the weight of the drag lines that are used for phosphate production. This particular unit doesn't seem like much. It still weighs 500 million pounds. I mean, this is a very heavy piece of equipment. What's really interesting about conventional mining, and I already mentioned this, so I'm going to get through this, is the way in which they mine. And we have a team of mine engineers that are involved in evaluating and looking at new approaches to increase the efficiency of ore capture associated with that mining operation. The two primary techniques that are utilized, one is this long room and pillar, and that's the one that's represented on the right side of your screen as you're looking at it as the observer. In this particular one, we actually mine a little bit higher amount of the ore body relative to the one that we actually have two operations that utilize the room and pillar, and we have two that actually utilize the herringbone approach. I got to start moving. I'm going to run out of time. I'm probably already out of time. What's really cool about specifically the mining operations, specifically when you start talking about greater depths where these mining operations are occurring, we actually have, anybody familiar with the Blairmore Formation? All the Canadians are probably familiar, at least with the, if you've flown into Saskatoon, did you see the Blairmore Ring? They're on the left side as you're exiting the airport. Nobody's ever flown into Saskatoon. I find that hard to believe. We actually have a deposit that's this Blairmore Formation. I think it's right around 1,000 feet below the soil surface, where we have high-pressure water that they actually had to bore through, and we actually have our shafts running through in order to bring ore from the below-ground operation to the surface. That was quite the engineering feat to figure out how to bore through water. And I'm not going to, you'll have to come and talk to me later, or maybe we can do it in the session, the panel discussion at the end. The really interesting thing about all the ore that's mined below ground, it's never touched by human hands. There's no buckets associated with these operations. We basically go straight from the miner. There's actually a conveyor system that feeds into the middle of that miner. It goes right into a conveyance system. There's actually a bridge that attaches where the miner's operating, where it's actually mining, to a permanent, semi-permanent conveyor that actually takes it back to the skips that you see here that actually take the material up to the surface. Now, these particular skips can hold up to 45 tons of material, and they cycle about every 90 seconds. So we can move a tremendous amount of material to the surface in a short period of time. We then crush that material. Got 3 minutes. We then crush that material to size. Part of the reason for that is so that we can separate the various mineral fractions that are there, and the smaller the size of grind, that's probably no surprise if you're a chemist, the more effective we can be at separating the potassium chloride salt from the sodium chloride salt. It's also a way for us to get rid of any inert materials that may be contained in a lot of the clays that are present within that particular material. Just like what is done within the phosphate side, once it's dry crushed, every other crushing procedure is going to occur within a brine solution. It's the most effective way for us to maneuver material within the particular milling operations. Just like Kyle said, we reuse and recycle almost every bit of water that we bring into our production system. And when you think about the nature of salts, does it make a lot of sense to introduce a lot of fresh water into the manufacturing system? Because what happens when you introduce fresh water to a salt? You're going to get dissolution. Not a good idea. We then separate that potassium chloride from the ammonium chloride. We actually add a specific amine, and it actually binds with that potassium chloride salt. It causes it to float, and then we are essentially skimming off all of that potassium chloride material. This is actually my last slide. Now, a lot of the operations associated with potassium production, specifically from a mining perspective, are done with dry mines and dry shafts. One of the largest threats to any of the potassium deposits and the potassium miner operations that are going on globally is the influx of water. How many did any reading about what happened to the potash mine in Russia this past year? Anybody see the sinkholes? Okay. That was a result of water inflow within that operation. It wasn't owned by PCS at the time, but we actually have a solution mine that we operate at Patience Lake. And that mine was lost as a dry mine because of water inflow, and they couldn't overcome the water inflow. So now we actually use a solution mining procedure. The way we actually extract the ore body is dramatically different. We inject a hot brine that's saturated with potassium or saturated with sodium chloride. We leave that in that particular mine. We've already got a lot of the cuts there, so we've got exposure of the ore. And leave that there for 3 months, upwards of 3 months. Bring that material back to the surface, and we recrystallize that potassium chloride in settling ponds on the surface. It's a dramatically different process for the production of the fertilizer coming out of that particular mine. There were a few more issues I could have covered, but I ran out of time. I thank you for your attention. My guess is we don't have questions. Save them for the panel discussion. Thank you very much.